This is Prescription Life with Dr. Matthew Harrison on Carolina Catholic Radio Charlotte, 1270 AM. Now here is your host for Prescription Life, Dr. Matthew Harrison.
Hello, and thank you for joining us today on Prescription Life, where we talk about healthcare and medical services through the lens of Catholic ethical framework. I'm really excited today to have Tracy Windsor with us today. She is with a fantastic organization called Be Not Afraid, which is a, I'm going to let her explain it, but just briefly, it's a essentially a neonatal hospice type of a program. They provide counseling for parents who have received a poor diagnosis for their baby before it's born. And then they provide a lot of counseling and care for them. And I'd just like to welcome her to the show. Tracy, how are you?
Fine, thank you. Thank you so much for having me and for your kind words about our work at Be Not Afraid.
Yeah, I'm really excited about it. I've heard about you for years. And I have a little bit of a personal interest in this because I did have a sister who was stillborn. We didn't know that there was anything wrong until the very, very last, since the last few days, right before my mother was induced, and really was a pivotal point for me going into kind of pro-life activism, really kind of set me on a path towards that. So this I understand the need for this, how important it is, how healing it is, and it really gives folks a different perspective and a way of looking at babies before they're born and even after they're born that have really kind of serious prognosis or serious type of a diagnosis. Tell me how you got involved with this. Tell me a little bit about the program. I know that you're based in Atlanta, Georgia. Tell me about Be Not Afraid.
So Be Not Afraid was, we started development about 14 years ago. My co-founder and I were working in loss ministry in Catholic parishes, and we just had a year where we were encountering families kind of regularly that had experienced a prenatal diagnosis and carried to term, in some cases quietly because they didn't know how to share information about a devastating diagnosis. And in other cases, we found Catholic women who had ended a pregnancy when that was offered and nothing else was offered, and without really understanding that was an abortion. So we started thinking somebody needs to be providing care for these families at the time of diagnosis, and that had us embark on some research and ultimately led to the development of our program.
Nice. And so you started, looking into that. And what are the statistics, if you know any of them, about, you know, what percentage of women have a poor prenatal diagnosis with pregnancies?
You know, we used to say 3%. I don't think that there has ever been a really well-established figure for data that was captured. I would suggest that number is increasing in terms of percentages because of the offering of NIPT testing, non-invasive prenatal tests, or sometimes they're called cell-free DNA tests, which are these blood tests that are routinely offered to mothers now. That wasn't the case, say, 8 years ago. And oftentimes these tests are offered as a way to determine gender as soon as possible. But ultimately what ends up happening is parents don't realize it's looking at other genetic syndromes. And so more and more women are getting conflicting information from such tests, or sometimes misleading information from some tests, sometimes accurate information from tests, but they're getting it a lot sooner because women are more likely to do a blood test than they are to do, say, a CVS or an amniocentesis. So I just think the number, the percentage of people who are finding that their pregnancy has been complicated with difficult news is probably increasing.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. And, you know, generally we kind of quote statistics anywhere from 3 to 5% in the general population. But I think that number probably is going to be rising over time because we're seeing more women that are delaying pregnancy longer. And so we're getting more advanced maternal age patients where typically they have a higher risk of having some type of birth defect, such as Down syndrome or, you know, something like that. So, yeah, I think it's going to be really important to support this group. And this is really part of the pro-life ethic is to, you know, we're not here to essentially attack the baby. We're here to essentially treat the baby the same way in the womb as we would if the baby was out of the womb. And if they have that diagnosis, we certainly wouldn't purposely end their life after they were born. So we don't want to do that before they're born as well. But instead, we want to support the parents, help them with counseling, help them with, you know, medical decisions, because there can be a lot of them. And of course, we also want to alleviate suffering, and that suffering extends to the baby as well.
I think there's a lot of research, too, just since you brought that up. You can really make the case for informed consent medically supports the idea that it is better emotionally for mothers to carry to term, even if the birth is going to result in a death. And that's research that exists. It's just that so often the medical community isn't aware of that research. And so parents who get a prenatal diagnosis may not be given all their options, but very often, very infrequently, do they understand that there's a medical benefit for mom to carry to term.
Yes, and I really think that most obstetricians and maternal-fetal medicine doctors are trying to be sympathetic and compassionate by trying to, you know, get things over quickly.
Yes.
By offering abortion. I really don't think that they're trying to be sinister or trying to be, you know, trying to do anything bad. I think that they just don't understand, many of them don't understand the grieving process and also the long-term effects on mothers who have agreed to have someone intentionally in the life of their child. And so I think it's really important for doctors to understand that this service is available and can help the doctors and the patients navigate, you know, the end of life process for babies there.
You know, when we started our service, we thought of ourselves as just, we used to say we're a couple of wacky Catholic women, no one's going to refer to us. And we knew that we needed referrals from the medical community. And what we've really found is that doctors who are not Catholic and who may not share the same pro-life mindset that we have are very happy to refer because they know that parents will be well cared for. And I think that speaks to the fact that they're not necessarily trying to limit parents' opportunities for what to do when there's a prenatal diagnosis. The reality is they're just not aware of all the information and all the options that may exist.
Yes, I know from personal experience, you know, I had a patient who actually was an employee in our office who ended up with a trisomy 18 prenatal diagnosis for their baby, which for those in the audience who don't know, essentially is a terminal not compatible with life for more than a few hours generally outside of the womb. There have been isolated cases where trisomy 18 children have lived for a good amount of time, but generally extremely developmentally delayed, have a lot of different birth defects. And her prenatal diagnosis included an omphalocele, which is where the intestines are essentially developing outside of the body. And she also had hydrocephalus. And so she would not be able to deliver this baby vaginally. And so that was a very important thing to think about for the family, for future pregnancies. You know, does she want to have a C-section? And so that's one thing that many OB doctors will talk to their patients about. You know, if we do an abortion instead of a C-section, then the baby essentially can come out in parts, you know, in body parts,
right.
Which, you know, can really scare mothers. It's scary. It's something that they kind of have flashbacks on and can have really nightmares about. And so she ended up deciding to have a C-section and carried the baby to term, had a C-section, mm-hmm. delivered a beautiful baby girl. They held that baby for about 4.5 hours, you know, while the baby just, you know, calmly went to sleep, and is a real great healing process for her whole family. The grandparents were there. They were able to have a body that they were able to bury and have a funeral. And it, you know, to this day, she's very thankful for that whole process that allowed her to respect a baby's dignity and to give them time to properly grieve and then go on with life, you know. So it was really great for her.
Right. I think that really speaks to the emotional benefit for a family, mm-hmm. And the opportunity to have a story that can be told. You know, we frequently find that parents at diagnosis think that the train wreck, if you were going to give kind of an idea of emotionally what this looks like, that the train wreck is going to be the birth and the baby, whatever baby's circumstances. But we have research now that says that the prenatal diagnosis is actually the traumatic event for upwards of 80% of both mothers and fathers. And that's without regard to the nature of the diagnosis. So it could be a heart defect or that offers surgical options. It could be trisomy 18, could be Down syndrome, but it is expected or experienced by the parents as unexpected and life altering. And it changes everything they thought they understood about themselves as parents, what they were going to be doing as parents and their baby, and what they can expect from their pregnancy. And so we often say to parents, you know, you are in the train wreck right now. The train wreck is the diagnosis, and the birth can be better with support, because at least at the birth, you will not be blindsided. And if we've done our job well, you have plenty of opportunity to make a plan for what you need around the birth. And for many parents, that might be getting to a live birth with a C-section, maybe with a baby who's frail, and making that decision and being happy with that decision. And we just find again that the medical community is very flexible in ways that we never expected when parents can articulate what they need around a birth to make those births better than really what those abortions look like.
Yeah, and I think it's important to stress to mothers that even though the baby has a poor prenatal diagnosis, that right now that baby is in the safest place, most comfortable place that he or she can be in. And that's very comforting for the mother to know that she is still able to care for this baby, even though there may be something terribly wrong. She feels a real purpose in that.
Right.
Yeah. So.
Right. We always say God doesn't send a baby to destroy, and there's still opportunities for happiness and for joy.
Right.
And I think that oftentimes others are quite surprised at how joyful, and I'm sure the birth that you described was quite joyful.
It really was.
How joyful a birth can look when you know that you have a very short time with a baby.
Yeah, of course, it was bittersweet, but very joyful, and they were able to get pictures, they were able to get footprints. You know, it was really healing. So, okay, well, we're going to take a little break. Thank you so much for tuning in today. We'll be back in just a moment.
Carolina Catholic Parish News. St. Dorothy in Lincolnton invites you to a retreat entitled How Your Personality Affects Your Discipleship. This is a 2-day retreat on April 14th and 15th at the Catholic Conference Center in Hickory. Discover how your personality impacts your discipleship. Learn how to make meaningful connections with people in your life and create a powerful plan for growth on your spiritual journey. Register early at njackson at the Eremos group.com. That's Eremos group.com. Queen of the Apostles is offering a new ministry for work at home or homeschooling dads on Thursday, April 27th from 12:30 to 2:30. Come join other dads for a time of fellowship and faith. Kids Zone will be open and available for children. For information, contact Brendan at bsweeney1759@gmail.com. For the Carolina Catholic Media News, I'm Pam Cullen. God bless y'all.
This is Tammy Harris. I am the founder and executive director of the Ursus Institute. We fight human trafficking both locally and abroad. I'm also a parishioner at St. Gabriel Catholic Church in Charlotte, as well as the Respect Life coordinator there. I urge you to check out my website, www.ursusinstitute.net, or to reach out to me personally at my email, tammy@ursusinstitute.net. Ursus is Latin for bear and is spelled U-R-S-U-S. And my first name, Tammy, is T-A-M-M-Y. We're involved in many operations right now, such as opening a transitional home for survivors in Western North Carolina. We're involved in a documentary about our work and about the realities of human trafficking, both locally and abroad. We're also giving input into anti-human trafficking legislation, involved in intel operations and rescue operations. There's many other things I'd like to share with you, and there's many ways that you can get involved. So I urge you, please text me at 704-519-7901, email me at tammy@ursusinstitute.net, or check out our website, www.ursusinstitute.net. And again, Ursus is spelled U-R-S-U-S. And please be assured that this human trafficking nonprofit works against trafficking in a way that is aligned with Catholic social teaching. Thanks for your time, and I look forward to hearing from you.
Hello and welcome back. Thank you so much for joining us today. And today we have with us Tracy Windsor, who is with an organization called Be Not Afraid, a national organization. Tracy, do y'all have any international outreach how national are you at this point?
So we've kind of changed things this year, pulled back from our national support, but we, in past years, say in the last 5 years, we've been serving nationally. I don't have the number in front of me, but I feel like we've supported families in 35 different states. That's the number that comes to mind. Mm-hmm. And we've also supported families internationally in England and New Zealand and Australia. And we are in the process of training an organization in New Zealand right now in our model of care. So we've had way more national and international involvement than we ever dreamt a couple of wacky pro-life Catholic women would ever manage to do when we started this.
Yeah, and we'll talk in a little bit about kind of a reboot that y'all are kind of getting ready to do. But I wanted to see if I could get, if you have any stories of women who that really kind of jumped out at you, stories that you really remember that were very effective in your work with parents in these situations?
I think, people always like to hear stories where maybe a diagnosis was not, or a prognosis that was given prenatally was not as significant or severe as what parents were led to believe. We do see a good deal of time that if there is a genetic syndrome that's called Turner syndrome, a diagnosis of Turner syndrome, it can be kind of hard to give a prognosis because sometimes babies are lost early in pregnancy, and they're called Turner's girls. Only little girls can have Turner syndrome, and they have some real mild intellectual delay sometime. They're short in stature, and as adult women, they're infertile. But and they may have heart defects, but a lot of times these girls have some swelling in utero, so it can be hard to decide if what you're seeing is something called fetal high drops, or if it's something less significant than that. Also, sometimes these girls will have something called a cystic hygroma. So we have had families that had losses, preterm losses, and then families who didn't. We served a family, young couple. Dad was in the Army overseas, and they're pregnant with their second child, and mom gets the diagnosis of Turner syndrome. And there's a cystic hygroma, and for whatever reason, the doctors were very heavily convinced that this baby was not going to live. Mom was offered termination and declined. And of course, she's dealing with her husband being overseas. And she had moved away from the military, so they were in a civilian hospital, and so she was in a new city and trying to navigate that as well. And the doctors were just so unwilling to give her any hope that she drove around. We actually provided her with a loss box for a small baby. And she told me later she drove around with that box in her trunk because she was always afraid something was going to happen. She was going to have an hour to get to the hospital, and she wanted to make certain that she had the burial gown for Camille, the blanket for Camille, and the memory-making kit for Camille. And ultimately, she got to term, and Camille was born, and she had a mild heart issue, but was a healthy baby that ended up going home within about 2 weeks of birth. So that would be a story kind of where we see the potential sometimes for doctors to just be so reluctant to provide a little bit of hope for parents, even after the parents have committed to carrying to term. I would say that we've had one really shocking misdiagnosis in 15 years and 300 plus families, but it's a powerful one, probably worth mentioning, and that was a family had an early ultrasound. I'm going to say they were about 9 weeks, maybe 10 weeks, and it was determined that baby had anencephaly, which means that the skull doesn't develop and the brain doesn't develop, but these babies basically have no skull from about the, say, the eyebrows all the way down to the back of the head, maybe where the neck is. And they were referred to us, and we were serving, and mom a couple times brought up that the ultrasound didn't look that way to her. And so, you know, oftentimes parents are trying to, you know, make sense of things. It's, you know, sometimes parents are struggling with the diagnosis. So I didn't think anything about it, but eventually after a week or two, I said, you know what, send me that ultrasound. And I'm not a medical person, but it's not hard to see anencephaly probably. And she sent me an ultrasound that did not look like anencephaly. So I sent it to a neonatologist on our medical advisory board. And he was like, that's not anencephaly. And we got her in for a second opinion to another doctor who said that's not anencephaly, and sent her to a new maternal fetal medicine specialist who said, you know, every day I sit down and I look at the patients that are going to be coming in that day, and I think about the conversations I'm going to have with them. And I would have never dreamt that looking at the basic information I had about you, that I would have you come in today and do a scan and be standing here telling you that your baby does not have anencephaly. And in fact, your baby looks completely typical. We ended up supporting that family, that couple, because they clearly had had all the trauma of a prenatal diagnosis.
Yeah.
And it was very hard for mom to make the switch to good news. She said, before the delivery, she said either they were wrong about the diagnosis or they're wrong about the baby being okay. And I can't make a decision which way that's going to be until I see baby. So we ultimately had a healthy baby something as horrifying as a diagnosis of anencephaly at 10 weeks.
Yeah, that's wild. And, you know, the OBGYN community is so, you know, fearful of litigation. And, you know, that litigation fear extends well beyond birth, essentially up until they're an adult. And so a lot of them really want the quick answer of abortion, try again, that type of thing, because it relieves them essentially of all liability if there's anything wrong with the baby.
Right. And especially for a baby who might live.
Yeah,
which
right.
Might sometimes be the situation we see with Turner's girls. We also see that if the diagnosis is spina bifida, for instance, it seems like parents are given the worst case scenario.
Yeah. Now, are you also involved with the family? Okay, so suppose a baby, you know, is born, and they have a condition that's not compatible with, you know, prolonged life, essentially with leaving the hospital. Are you involved with the family for the end of life care after birth?
Yeah. We're supportive, of course. Again, we're not a medical organization,
right.
So
right.
Our role is in making certain that parents have really kind of covered all the bases they needed to cover. And there's, you know, as you can well imagine, sometimes parents will be like, I need to have certainty before I can let a baby go. And then we prenatally are all about encouraging them to make connections to a community-based hospice provider. We'll help them vet that provider so that if by chance a baby can manage to get home, that's an option for them, mm-hmm. and they know who the caregiver will be at home when they take that baby home.
Nice.
Relative to a baby that had a short life, it was actually one of the last births I was at with a baby named Harrison. And he had Potter syndrome, and that means the kidneys don't develop, and mm-hmm. so there wasn't sufficient amniotic fluid. And when there's not sufficient amniotic fluid, babies don't develop lungs appropriately. So we imagine we have a baby for whom breathing is not going to be possible. And his parents decided that they wanted to have a C-section to get to a live birth. And we were able to help them advocate with their hospital system to have a priest in the OR to baptize baby, because we knew that baby might have 15 minutes. Harrison might have 15 minutes of a beating heart and no respirations. We hated the idea that he would have to be taken away from mom for a baptism. So we said, mm-hmm. is there any possibility we could get a priest in there? A priest can baptize with mom and a photographer to take pictures. All that happened. And sometimes babies don't get the memo. So Harrison started breathing. Mm-hmm. And he lived for about 4 hours mm-hmm. outside of the OR by the grace of God.
Wonderful.
And we were able to support that family. Even up until discharge, I came back the day that mom was discharged. They kept his body with them for that 3-day period, I think. And I was there helping when the funeral director came to collect Harrison's body. Mm-hmm. So we try to be as available as we can be with memory making. And oftentimes one of the things that we can do that will really help is be around when a funeral director comes to get baby, because that can mm-hmm. be such an emotional
yes,
time.
Absolutely. And you had mentioned something about, what, you know, your patients had, you know, essentially a small box, for the baby's body, if they were to lose the baby outside of the hospital, that type of thing, or at the hospital. What type of services like that are, I mean, do y'all help with those material things? You said like maybe some type of a comfort care kit or something.
Yeah. We
memory
do a lot
making,
of parent
yeah.
gifts, and we realize the value of this because so often others are reluctant to acknowledge baby by giving gifts. You know, friends mm-hmm. and family may feel uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. So we've always had several things that we give. So for instance, each family gets two identical blankets, the little pretty blue ones for little boys and little pretty mm-hmm. pink ones for little girls, with the mindset being that if you have some time with baby alive, or even if you just have time with the body, you have wrapped baby in that blanket, and you may want to keep that blanket as a keepsake. It
right.
was the one that baby was wrapped in. But at the same time, you don't want to remove a blanket from baby for baby to go to the funeral home. So in our case, we gave you two.
Okay.
You could keep the one that baby had been wrapped in and put the identical one on baby to go to the funeral home. We also have like personalized blankets that have baby's name that someone sews for us, a group sews for us. Burial gowns that can be christening gowns. Sometimes babies do better than expected. We do rosaries. We do, for the families that aren't Catholic, we might do a matching mom and baby bracelet with a cross. We have one of our families that we served developed a NICU box that's like a welcoming to NICU box mm-hmm. that has some, you know, sweet little things in it for parents and for baby. And we also have a loss box for the families that have a loss that was developed by our volunteers that head up our bereavement support program. So we do a lot with parent gifts. We also help with funeral planning. We have some limited funding we can offer to parents, and oftentimes we can help them figure out the best funeral home mm-hmm. that will offer discounted services. A lot of times in a lot of communities, there will be a funeral director who has some experience of infant loss themselves, so they'll be willing to do mm-hmm. everything for free. So we're involved in helping parents figure that out as well.
Nice. And yeah, I know that there are some Catholic cemeteries who have special sections essentially for babies that were lost through miscarriage or were stillborn, and they're smaller plots and they're less expensive, and lots of times they'll have a little angel statue something like that in that area. So those are available.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Well, this is a really great conversation. Thank you so much. We're going to take a little break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the Be Not Afraid reboot.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Kara Griffin from the Catholic Charities Human Trafficking Awareness Committee. On April 17th at 7 p.m., St. Aloysius Parish in Hickory, North Carolina will host a community forum entitled Stop Human Trafficking: How Our Community Can Take Action. This free event will spotlight the existence of human trafficking in our communities. The event will feature speakers from Charlotte FBI, Homeland Security Investigation, The Third Talk, Real Men Protect, and representatives from local safe houses, Hope for Justice, and On Eagle's Wings. This free event is open to the public. To learn more about the Catholic Church's response to human trafficking, go to www.ccdoc.org/human trafficking. That's ccdoc.org/human trafficking. Thank you.
Faith and charity are key elements of life, but are they at the center of your retirement planning and life insurance decisions? Knights of Columbus, a trusted organization with a proud history of more than 140 years of helping its members, can help Catholic families with insurance and retirement planning solutions. Most importantly, we do this in a way that is compatible with Catholic teaching and the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops Investment Guidelines. Today, we have expanded our offerings to include retirement annuities, long-term care insurance, and disability income insurance. Beyond the benefits of financial protection, members may take satisfaction in knowing that Knights of Columbus contributes to causes that align with Catholic moral teaching. Let your faith inspire your financial decisions. Terms and conditions apply. Learn more by calling Field Agent Bob Gordon at 516-551-7838.
And welcome back to Prescription Life. If you enjoy programming like this, please be sure to go to CarolinaCatholicMedia.org. Hit the donate button, help support all of the different fantastic programs that we have on this network. And today with us, we have Tracy Windsor, who is one of the co-founders of Be Not Afraid, a parent and family support group that helps to support families that have a poor prenatal diagnosis. And as I understand, Tracy, y'all are about to have kind of a reformatting, a regrouping of Be Not Afraid. You're stepping back a little bit from direct patient or family counseling just for a brief time so that you can reorganize, retrain. Tell me what kind of brought y'all to this decision, and we can talk a little bit more about the training that's going to go into for your volunteers and counselors.
Yes. So it's probably been coming, kind of this idea of a reboot. That's actually such a great word, for about 3 years. And in essence, what happened was we started serving parents nationally. And because there was a need and we didn't have services that we could refer them to that provided the same kind of service that we provided. And I think our busiest year was about 3 years ago. We served 70 families in 1 year. And and it's a lot easier to serve families in California and Texas than it is to raise money in California and Texas. And we felt like it was a nice thought that our little small North Carolina-based service could serve the country, but it was probably not the most reasonable business model. And we felt called to start reaching out to other organizations to at least make the case that the pro-life community could be doing more around prenatal diagnosis. So we engaged in conversation with Heartbeat International and the Charlotte Lozier Institute. We had other organizations that had been supportive of us over time, APLOG and the National Catholic Bioethics Center. So we had others that we could say, hey, this is something we think is important, and they were interested. And it just seemed to us that probably one of the things that could happen was we could take what we had learned in then it was like 12 years or 11 years of service and create a training that would prepare others to develop their own services in California, in Texas, in Oregon, in Michigan, so on and so forth. And we, over time, we had started initially all those years ago as a peer ministry, but over time, as the needs of parents became more comprehensive and as we learned more, we realized that we were providing case management support. So the training that we're providing for the pro-life community is a service case management support, parent-centered, trauma-informed, and we call it our parent care coordinator training. That's what we call the staff members we have that work directly with parents. And so we have, we're in the middle of our first class. We're working through the curriculum right now with our first class of 14 organizations that will graduate in April. And so far, so good.
So the training lasts how long?
You know, it's a lot of it is online. And so this group is kind of our guinea pigs. I don't know that I have an answer for you. There's a lot of recorded content. Mm-hmm. There's some live content. There's over 30 lessons. We have 6 chapters. And we were very fortunate because we've been in this space providing kind of a different approach to perinatal hospice. So we had a lot of doctors and Catholic ethicists and bereavement people who were willing to support us by being part of our training program. So we have trainers that are infinitely more interesting than like me. And so it's a very comprehensive program. Mm-hmm. I think this group officially will have started, I believe they started February 1st, and they've been a little delayed because we, you know, we're rolling out this chapter and then rolling out this chapter and mm-hmm. so on and so forth. So it's going to take them 2 months. I think the next class, it won't take that long because everything will be ready for them to just move through it.
Are you finding that people, or maybe you haven't found this yet, but do you anticipate that people training in different areas of the country are going to have different resources at their disposal and it may require their training to be a little bit different depending on where they're located?
You know, yes. And on, that was one of the things, you know, people said to us, well, what you should do, Be Not Afraid should become a national org and you should have chapters and blah, blah, blah. And our sense was, number one, that we just didn't really feel called to that. But we also felt like, you know, if we could provide you with the training, if we could provide your organization with the training, then you take the best of us and you go back and you have to discern and figure out what your assets are and what you can do. Maybe even you improve on what we've done. And certainly you can provide a service that's specific to your community, only because we're providing you with the training, we're not giving you our name. So we have very different orgs. We have the Archdiocese of Newark is developing this service through their disability ministry. The Archdiocese of Philadelphia is developing it through Catholic Charities. There is a parish that's sending 2 people to this training in Texas. And then we have, you know, kind of medical pro-life organizations that are like crisis pregnancy centers, but with, say, a nurse midwife on staff. One of those in Atlanta, they're doing the training. Another one in Wisconsin, they're doing the training. So the orgs are different, and their communities will be different, and we intend to provide them with the flexibility, the best of what we know, and then the flexibility for them to go back and meet the needs in their community as best they can.
Yeah, I certainly see that there are a lot of organizations that do fantastic work, but if they're not careful, they will really get into mission drift. It's very tempting to try to save the world, and you spread yourself too thin, and then before you know it, people are burned out. They're not being effective in what they're called to do initially. And I think it's really important to keep that in check and in a good balance.
One of the things that we had learned was we when we were first starting this, we looked around at other pro-life organizations that were providing perinatal hospice services. And many of them had a hard time getting referrals. That seemed to be a huge hurdle. Wasn't our difficulty, but it was for many other orgs. And so consequently, when you talk about mission creep, their perinatal hospice services had just kind of become more like grief support services because they could get referrals after the birth, but that's not really perinatal hospice. So, we have been laser focused on prenatal diagnosis, and we're really encouraging these organizations to do the same. And I think, even in the Catholic community, where sometimes other services that have been provided in the past are getting difficult to provide, adoption services and things, this is a place where Catholic organizations can really step up and make a difference, whether they're doing it through Disability Ministry or Family Life or Catholic Charities. So we've been very pleased. We have one Catholic hospital system. I won't say where they are because I don't want to out them, but they have been thinking about it, and we are praying that they come back around to us and decide to do the training.
And of course, like you said, every place geographically is different, and as you gave examples, different dioceses may fund this differently, because of how it might fall under them. And what you're doing, the way you're doing it, gives them great flexibility in the ability to take advantage of it. By having all these different avenues or choices, can fund it different ways. So that's really good. So, it sounds like this is some pretty formal, I'm not going to say intense training, but very directed, very focused, purposeful training. And I'm sure it takes a lot of time, takes a lot of effort. Takes a good amount of money. How much does it cost to train a person or a counselor for Be Not Afraid?
So right now our charge for the training program, and then we're providing mentoring support after the fact for 1 year, is $1,000. And that was the hardest decision I think we've ever made at Be Not Afraid. I don't think we've ever charged for anything. But we were encouraged to do that, partially too because the larger organizations that support us were really of the opinion that we needed to make certain we got really kind of serious service providers. We're hopeful that we can get that price down. But that's the current price right now, is $1,000 for the training and then ongoing mentoring.
Yeah, and I think that's a deal when you consider what you get for it. And people, I think that people are going to want to do that because, people need to, the counselors and the folks that are sending the counselors need to have, some money in the game. They need to have something at stake. And that helps them kind of put their, put their money or put their treasures where their hearts are. I think that's very important. And it also enables y'all to, pay counselors to pay for all of the development of the training seminars and all that. I mean, none of that stuff is free. So I think I think it's wise. I think it's a good move. And I think it's very doable for anyone who's serious about providing this very important ministry to families that are suffering. So I think that's really great. So I didn't really hear, I didn't really ask you, but is there a mission statement for Be Not Afraid, or is there somehow it's tied specifically to Catholic ethics?
Yeah, so we, I have to pull it up on the website. We do have a mission statement on the website. Mm-hmm. And I should know the mission statement by heart, but I don't.
That's fine.
We are a Catholic organization, and we are serving a lot of different families. Sometimes people are reluctant to refer, or they feel like if they're not Catholic, they may not find community with us. But we always say our Catholic ethics inform our care of families. And we follow Catholic ethics relative to the issues of prenatal testing, the issue of abortion, and the issue of end-of-life care. And we actually have been, in our work with the National Catholic Bioethics Center, we've been able to provide them with a chapter on their premier book for medical providers addressing this issue of prenatal diagnosis. So we over time have become kind of a very strong voice around the issue of prenatal diagnosis and caring to term within the Catholic community. But our primary mission statement is to secure support for direct support for parents caring to term following a prenatal diagnosis. And that support, as I said, is based on case management, which is parent-centered and kind of problem-driven. You know, if this is your issue, let's figure out how we can solve that. We work closely with parents to help them be their best advocates, recognizing that the prenatal diagnosis is a traumatic event. These parents have to go back to the site of their trauma, the hospital. And so we really help them with talking points. And most of our parents, I think it's 95% of our parents in our most recent parent survey, felt like we improved the relationship that they had with their medical providers. So we're very focused on helping them be better advocates for themselves, knowing that they have to work with their medical providers. And then we support parents for 1 year following the birth. For many of our parents, that's a loss. For some of our parents, that's a baby who has several heart surgeries. Sometimes it's babies that are home and are medically complicated. You mentioned those kids with trisomy 13 or 18 who do better than expected. So we're around for a year after baby is born.
Great. Okay, well, we'll take another break, and when we come back, we will wrap up one more segment. Thank you so much for sharing your afternoon with us. Thank you.
On January 31st, 2019, Carolina Catholic Media signed on Charlotte's first Catholic radio station, AM 1270 WCGC. By the grace of God, we celebrate the past 4 years and look forward to continuing our apostolic vision and mission to serve the Carolina Catholic community. We are evangelistic partners with our clergy, active parishioners, the fallen away, and the homebound. We are accessible to all Christians, agnostics, and atheists. With distribution of a wide array of content across 7 media platforms, there truly is something for everyone. During these past 4 years, Carolina Catholic has expanded to 7 media platforms that include radio, internet stream, mobile app, website, YouTube, social media, and e-newsletter. Nearly all local programs are available by podcast and video on demand. In the year ahead, we're committed to promote more local parish, school, and ministry events, more live broadcasts, and more valuable content that showcases our dynamic local Carolina Catholic community. Of all the Catholic radio stations in the U.S., Carolina Catholic is arguably a leader in locally produced programs. To continue our work, Carolina Catholic Media needs $15,000 in monthly funding to continue operations across our 7 media platforms. We are 100% dependent on your generosity. If you love what we're doing, please join us with a monthly tithe or annual gift. We have partnership plans available for parishes, schools, and ministries. If you own a business, You can be a program sponsor on one or all of our platforms. You can do a live broadcast of a special event with promotion before and rebroadcast after. On behalf of everyone at Carolina Catholic Media, we thank you for your past support and look forward to you joining us with the resources the apostolate needs to continue to evangelize the truth of Jesus Christ and our Catholic faith across the Carolinas. May God bless you and your family abundantly.
Welcome back to Prescription Life. Today we're talking with Tracy Windsor. So thankful that she has taken the time to come on and speak to us about this very important ministry, Be Not Afraid, offering counseling and care to families with babies that have a poor prenatal diagnosis. Tracy, I know that y'all are getting ready to go into a kind of a season of training, where you're not going to have a lot of direct patient care or contact. But I just want to know, how do people get in touch with you? Is there a website? Do they ask their doctor, you know, how to get in touch with you if they're looking for counseling or concern?
Yeah. Well, our website has a contact form. If you go to our website, which is www.benotafraid.net, at the top on the homepage, you'll see, I hate to say disclaimer, but it basically says we're not accepting referrals right now, but that parents can leave a contact form if they want. We will have this new group of 14 organizations that are ready to serve parents. So if someone wants to leave a contact form for us at our website, they're more than welcome to, and we can refer them on to one of the organizations that we've just trained. And as I said, we're providing mentoring to these organizations. So, for instance, a couple of weeks ago, one of the organizations received a referral locally. And we said, you know, as our mentoring, we said, why don't we get on the phone with this family and with your parent care coordinators, and we will work through what a first conversation looks like with a family so that you're learning from that experience. So we will not be serving parents directly ourselves, but in our mentoring, mm-hmm. we'll have our hands on families as they're being served by these other, our new organizations. I think the other thing that's really important to mention is that when we sat down with Heartbeat International and Charlotte Lozier Institute and said, there's more that the prenatal, or excuse me, that the pro-life community could be doing about prenatal diagnosis, those two organizations made the decision to support our training development and to refer organizations to us, but they felt strongly that there needed to be a prenatal diagnosis pro-life website. And so there is one now. It is not fully operational at the moment, but people can go there and look. It's prenataldiagnosis.org. And I say it's not fully operational. All the content is there. Ultimately, this website will provide parents with an immediate 24/7 link to Heartbeat's Option Line, and from Option Line, a referral to parent care coordinators that we've trained.
Great.
So in another year, there'll be a really successful way nationally for parents to connect immediately to the kind of support that we provide without necessarily connecting directly to us.
Great. And you know, I work closely with Heartbeat International on the Abortion Pill Reversal Network, and they have, I don't know, probably 2,500 crisis pregnancy centers internationally. They're in about 60 different countries. And so an organization like that could really make this ministry available to so many people. That's really great news.
Yeah. We feel very blessed to have been able to partner with them in this kind of comprehensive national development of a network that includes the website and access to Option Line, and then access to direct service.
Now, is Be Not Afraid a 501c3?
Yes.
Do y'all do fundraising and that type of thing, or you just...
Yes. You know, we're primarily, we are supported through private donations.
Mm-hmm.
Our burden of fundraising has not been that extreme. I would say the lion's share of our donations come by way of the families that we've supported. But then we have some other supporters in the community that also fund us. Our training program initially was funded by the Supreme Council of the Knights of Columbus. They're a primary funder for the development of this training.
Okay.
And then a secondary gift from the Lynch Foundation, which is a Catholic foundation in North Carolina.
What's the name of that organization?
Lynch, L-Y-N-C-H.
Gotcha.
It's the Lynch Family Foundation.
Gotcha, okay.
We're very appreciative of those two groups.
Yeah, that's great. Tell me something. Do you ever get much, you know, controversy or people pushing back saying, you know, you guys are just prolonging suffering, you're just giving families false hope, that type of thing? I mean, is there anybody that's kind of attacking you on any of this? Because it seems like such a helpful and caring ministry.
You know, we've been very fortunate. I think that as we became involved with Heartbeat and Charlotte Lozier, and of course, when we started this plan for a national network, we didn't know what was coming this year in terms of the Dobbs decision. And so everybody was a little, I think Heartbeat and our friends there were a little worried about us because we had never had any bad press or any controversy like that. I would say probably the only thing we've really had is occasionally you might have a birth at a hospital and have a singular nurse who has some angst about the service that we provide. So we've had some tangles that way. But we've been really very fortunate. And I think by and large, if someone has an opportunity to meet parents or to be at one of our births, I think it's hard to criticize us either for giving parents false hope because our parents are really well prepared and well informed.
Mm-hmm.
For the reality of a baby that's coming, we don't do anybody any good by not helping them get ready for the baby. And I just think these births look really, really good in ways that even, you know, sometimes we've had doctors that were not particularly supportive of carrying to term, maybe had been kind of difficult for the parents to deal with, but they show up at a birth and the next thing you know, they're crying too because it's beautiful,
yeah.
And it's such a precious opportunity mm-hmm. to be invited into that circle. And I think it's hard for people not to be at a birth like this and be unchanged. So we've been very fortunate by the grace of God. Not any official attacks and really very few kind of quiet private attacks.
Good. Yeah, well, you know, for many obstetricians, it's very easy to, you know, before a baby's born, to see that baby as a diagnosis or as a problem or as an obstacle or as something that needs to get fixed. But when that baby is born, all the humanity of that child kind of rushes, you know,
right.
on into the community. And it's really a beautiful event.
And I think sometimes, and this is fair, you know, I had my own fears when we started this work. I'd had my own two losses, but I didn't feel especially capable. I just knew that God was telling us we had to do this. And a lot of times people are acting out of their own, you know, inexperience. We were at a Catholic Medical Association conference. It was about a year ago. And a doctor was sharing, he was a general practitioner that did OB work, and he was sharing this story about a woman who had a prenatal diagnosis, and he said, ultimately, baby died before birth, which was really better. And I thought, not really, probably. and I said to him, I said, have you ever been at a birth with a baby who didn't breathe, because this was the scenario for the baby? He said, no, I've got to imagine that's terrible. And I said, actually, I've been at a lot of births with babies that didn't mm-hmm. breathe, kind of the way you described, where they get a little dusky and then they just mm-hmm. fall asleep. Mm-hmm. There's no struggle. It's not like a drowning.
Yeah.
It doesn't
yeah.
have any of the scary, horrible gasping. And I just told him that. And he said, wow, nobody had ever explained that to me. And I thought, okay, good. You can't fault somebody for what they, you know, they don't know. So we just hope, you know, with more and more births that we have more and more medical providers who gain more and more sensitivity, because this isn't something that's covered really well in medical school.
And no, not at all.
Most
not
parents all. Terminate, you know, most parents terminate.
Yeah.
So you may not get a great opportunity to see one of these births.
Yeah. And there's, you know, there's a lot of fear in the unknown. And
yeah,
there's also a lot of fear, especially with medical personnel, in things they can't control.
And that's fair.
And in ambiguous.
I would say, you know, it's easy for me. I'm standing at the NICU bedside and I have no responsibility for anything except just to care for people.
Yeah.
So I can, you know, I can appreciate how much different that experience is when you are supposed to be taking care of people and you have a responsibility to do so. And you would rather be in control. That's got to be hard. So,
yeah, I'm family practice board certified and did obstetrics. Obstetrics for all these years, and I noticed there's definitely a difference between the way I managed, you know, laboring patients and OBs, just because I think in general in my specialty there's a lot more ambiguity in diagnoses mm-hmm. and how patients are going to react to treatment and that type of thing. So. You know, I would let patients labor far longer if they're comfortable with it, far longer, as long as the baby was safe and mom was safe, than many of my colleagues would, because there's really a control thing and a fear thing. Oh, if baby's not descending according to the charts, then, you know, you better start the induction, that type of thing, kind of force things along.
Right.
So, that's such a fascinating ministry that you have, and I'm so appreciative to you for it. Anything else that you want to leave us with today before we sign off?
I just think that, for family members who have a loved one who receives a prenatal diagnosis, or even for family members who experience a loss, like with your sister, right, a stillbirth,
mm-hmm.
Just to remember that it can be very intimidating. Obviously, most of us who come in contact with a prenatal diagnosis, whether we're the parents or the grandparents or the aunts and uncles, it's generally the first one for us. But remember that parents are still expecting a baby, that the baby is still the same baby they had rejoiced in when they found out a baby was coming. And that for many, many parents around loss, one of the most painful things is when others don't acknowledge that baby. So never be afraid to say baby's name or mm-hmm. to remember baby. So often people think that if they do that, they'll be reminding the parents of the baby, when in truth, parents will never forget that baby. And having someone else remember baby is one of the greatest gifts that you can give them.
Yeah, I remember as a resident, a woman came into the emergency room and had had a fetal loss at 18 weeks. And when she lost the baby, the little body came out. And I held that little baby in my hand, in one hand, sat with that mom and watched the baby, you know, moving around and trying to take a few little breaths, but of course couldn't do anything at 18 weeks. And we just sat together and just kind of watch the baby and kind of mourn the loss. And that's so important, to just be with people. That's a big part of this, is just being with them through their pain, even though you can't fix anything, just being there with them.
Absolutely. That's a beautiful story. And I just have to say before we finish, what a lovely legacy for your sister, all the good work that you've done in medicine and with the abortion pill reversal, and just what an incredible legacy for that sister. Did she have a name?
Yes, we my parents named her Phyllis, and we celebrate her birthday every year, November 7th.
November 7th.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. What a lucky girl.
Okay, well, thank you so much for spending time with us today. And please reach out to me if there's anything that I can do to help your ministry. We'll be praying for you, and I'll be sending this out on the airways and letting people know that this important ministry is available. Thank you so much, and thank everyone for joining us today. Please be sure to go to CarolinaCatholicMedia.org. And again, if you want to see more programming like this, please hit the donate button and share this with all your friends. Thanks again, and God bless.
You've been listening to Prescription Life with Dr. Matthew Harrison on the Carolina Catholic Radio Network, 1270 AM Charlotte, and streaming at CarolinaCatholicMedia.org and on the Carolina Catholic Media app.